How was your Easter?
It was good. I was just running through in my head. I'm going to get an offer. Please write a parenting book like anytime now, just based on all the really outstanding stories I've told on this podcast so far. Our Easter was good. We did some things that we usually do. We did the Easter egg hunt. Some things were different. Mark's grandmother lives in town. She's in her 90s. And normally for holidays, she comes over to our house. But of course, we couldn't do that either. So yesterday, we drove over to her house and talked to her from the sidewalk. And she's a little hard of hearing. So you really are just standing, just shouting on the sidewalk, which is sort of ridiculous. And it was very hard. It was harder than I thought it was going to be. Because we've been going over there for several weeks now doing this laundry exchange, and it's usually pretty fun. Here's your laundry, blah, blah, blah. But for some reason yesterday, it just kind of drove home that everything is weird.
Yeah.
And said, we got to do it this way so we can see her on the next holiday in person. And, I don't know. Now I'm a downer. That just really of made it feel, weird.
Yeah. Yeah.
But our Easter baskets were very frou-frou this year because I've been afraid to go most places. I won't go to our chain grocery store here just because we have a superstore and it's humongous. Yeah. It's like the second largest one they have. And the parking lot gives me a panic attack. There's so many cars there. So I've been going to like a small specialty market.
Smart.
So everything in our kids' basket was like, very fancy.
Oh, decadent.
Very frou-frou. And they were a little bit like, where are my 9,000 robin's eggs? Like,
yeah.
What is this gourmet bunny thing? Anyway.
Shut up and eat it.
Right? How was your Easter?
I grew up Jewish, so I don't celebrate Easter.
You have now told me that on this podcast twice and I'm not retaining it.
I don't care. But I mean, Josh's family does, and like, so we had many Easter texts, and I think his dad maybe FaceTimed him, but I was busy filing for unemployment, and I don't really remember Easter. Like, we didn't celebrate it. We celebrated Christmas because my dad grew up Baptist, but it was not practicing, and my mom was a practicing Jewish person. So I don't know. It sounded like offensive suddenly to say she was a practicing Jew, but she was a practicing Jew. So I grew up going to Sunday school, and I was I went to Hebrew High and was confirmed in the Jewish faith. So we never celebrated Easter except for once.
Did you do Passover last week?
Do Passover last week, but I, of course, grew up celebrating Passover. I mean, honestly, just because it was just like no time to get everything correct, you know what I mean? Like, how do I make matzo ball soup suddenly? And it was just like not on my radar at all.
Yeah,
I remember one time my parents celebrated Easter with us, and but we were like older kids, and I like, and since my mom's Jewish, like it wasn't about the resurrection, it was really about the Easter bunny. And so then they had like the really awful task of trying to explain the Easter bunny to us and being like, so the Easter is laying. The bunny is laying eggs, and like we're getting something for it. And they were just like, yeah, we're never doing this again.
Yes. We had several years ago, we were trying to explain what the bunny had to do with Jesus. And I will say that it's a harder connection, I think, than when you talk about, I mean, like, Santa, at least St. Nicholas is an actual
saint.
How you tie the bunny in to the resurrection of Jesus is sort of, it's not a walk I can take. Nothing there.
Welcome to Book It,
a bi-weekly podcast where we talk frankly about books. Book It is hosted by the Blue Manatee Literacy Project,
a nonprofit that operates an independent bookstore in Cincinnati, Ohio.
When you shop with Blue Manatee, you are giving back to the community. For every book purchased, BMLP donates a book to a child in need.
Book It is hosted by me, Michael Woodson.
And me, Jill Burkett-Ragacy.
Well, anyway, there's no segue. Welcome to Book It. So this is part two of our school library conversation, We introduced Catherine in our last conversation, and Jill gave us a little bit of a background into the sort of the nuances of the problems within at least the Ohio situation. And we're really excited to bring you this episode because we're speaking with our second educator named Margie, and she works with the high school age students as an English teacher.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to hearing how differently it impacts a high school student. I mean, I don't have kids that age, so I have no idea what it looks like.
Well, and I haven't really thought about, wider than the conversation about access to books for students right now, I haven't thought about how teaching itself has changed so much since when I was in school. And I just liked hearing that perspective too, because when I think about when I was a kid, my first grade teacher and my high school English teachers were really important to, I guess, who I would become. And like my freshman year and senior year high school teacher was the same teacher. And she was one of the very first people I came out to. And my first grade teacher was one of the best teachers I've ever had. And I sobbed on the last day of school. And I don't give enough time to think about that and like the impact they had on me. And in talking to these educators, it is sort of making me think about the students now and the impact they're having on them, but also not having the resources that made that impact so much more intense for me. Like I had a library, and I had a classroom library, and Margie doesn't have a library. And so she's doing all of that work on her own. And I'm just curious for our listeners to hear that perspective.
Yeah, me too.
So yeah, let's jump right in and let's hear what Margie has to say.
Margie, thank you for sitting down and talking to us today. Would you like to maybe introduce yourself a little bit?
Sure. So my name is Margie Lytle, and I am a high school English teacher in Cincinnati, and I teach 9th and 10th grade English, and I teach a lot of English language learners, so that's pretty cool, and I'm surviving the coronavirus.
Yeah.
I feel like that's a place we all are now, where it's like a qualifier in everything that we do.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
on like a scale of like 1 to 2, how's everyone doing?
Two, yeah. I think.
I'm a solid 2 this morning.
Yeah, that's good.
So, Margie, we have been talking in this episode about the impact of the changes in availability of libraries and librarians to students and teachers in Ohio. And I had looked up some background information and statistics, and the most recent information I have is dated at 2016, but between 2000 and 2016, we saw a 63% decline in the number of licensed librarians or school media specialists working in the state of Ohio. And I am so troubled by it. And I'm excited that you're here today to talk about your experiences. And I'm wondering if you can just start us off with a little background. Have you been in schools where you had a librarian and now you don't? Have you never had one? What's the situation where you are?
Yeah, so in my first teaching job, we had a library, and it was pretty well stocked, but we didn't have a dedicated librarian, because I think the trend now in schools is for the librarian to kind of be also like the media specialist and also maybe a testing coordinator. So they're given a lot of different hats to wear. In the current school that I'm in, we don't even have a library, so we don't have any books. The space that used to be the library is called the Resource Center, and it's most often used as a classroom or a place for testing to take place.
Are there books in it?
No books.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So, but your students, I assume, are still reading books. Where do they come from?
Yeah, so I have my own personal library in my classroom that I've kind of just collected over the years. And I have a very primitive checkout system, and most of my books go missing. but I have kids donate books all the time, and then I give them out. So that's kind of what I do. A lot of kids have access to books on their own. Some of them go to the library, or the public library, that is. And then a lot of them are like, I'm not reading. So.
Yeah. Yeah. We had also spoken with another educator for this episode, and she also has a classroom library, and I see that in my children's school as well. And I do think it's a wonderful thing that when the kids are in the classroom, they can have such easy access to at least a limited variety of things, but it brings with it like new and different challenges. How do you feel having a classroom library is serving and meeting the needs of your students?
I would have to say it's probably not meeting the needs of most of my kids, because mm-hmm. a lot of the books that I can get for free are not necessarily appropriate for the kids that I teach. So I've got one of my largest classes is full of English language learners. And so they need books that are high interest, but also low difficulty. So a lot of those books that like we might think of as like storybooks that have a low Lexile level are designed for elementary students. And I've got high schoolers that have like very different real world experiences that they aren't necessarily interested in connecting to something that would be deemed childish. Yep. So it's very difficult to find resources that are going to be interesting to them, because then I run the risk of giving them something that I think that they would be interested in, but they can't read it because they just don't have the English vocabulary to do so.
Yeah, and lots of those high-low readers come from publishers that specialize in that type of content. And and because it's a smaller market, the prices are higher because the price of delivering that material is higher, and it just becomes this self-fulfilling prophecy of being hard to deliver.
Yeah. And I did, I went to a conference in November and I was able to connect with a distributor. I think it was Saddleback Education, and they were able to give me like 30 copies of some appropriate readers. Mm-hmm. But yes, I have to rely on free things.
Yeah. And then you also, I assume, are serving a diverse population. And a lot of times what's available for free is not particularly diverse.
Yes.
Yeah. That is definitely, definitely challenging. Do you have support from your local public library branch?
We do. I haven't been able to connect with them that much, but I know that they do have a very good like Spanish language selection of books. But again, it's hard for me to contact like outside resources just with all of the other responsibilities I have as a teacher. So I could definitely be doing more to, you know, get involved with them.
Yeah.
How, Margie, since you've had the experience between working at a school that has a variation of a library and then now one where it's really up to you, mm-hmm. what was the most surprising aspect of you, your job as an educator that you had to evolve when you took on a new job?
I guess I at my old school, I was able to take my classes down just for like some dedicated reading time or browsing time for books. So it was just like the accessibility was so much easier, and just the amount of titles available was easy. And I had, there's like an expert who can help me find appropriate books for my kids. Right. Now it's like all the pressure I feel like is on me to find the appropriate books. And I don't necessarily have the knowledge of what is appropriate, because I'm not an expert in like reading development. I'm an expert in like teaching kids how to write and read and speak in English at a high school level. So it's like, I don't have the skill set really to adapt.
Well, and to your point, I mean, it's kind of the same thing you're saying about how librarians' roles changed into being sort of all-encompassing media center mm-hmm. people. It's also asking you to be a professional at these things that, you're saying that you aren't. That's hard.
Yeah, and it seems such a shame, because if you're feeling this way, the other people in your building have to be feeling the same way too. And it echoes what we have heard from other educators who shop in the store, is, you know, they are in the business of teaching and they're serving their students and they're also being social workers and providing food and providing, you know, snacks. And we're asking so much of schools and teachers right now. And it feels a bit like we've taken this resource that everyone in the building was using and pushed that work out on everyone. And I hear the same struggles from everyone, and it's disheartening because the people who work in this space exist and we're not making them available to the people who need them.
And what's going on right now with virtual learning, have you found it even more challenging to engage your students in reading right now? I mean, I don't want to answer for you, but I would have to imagine that it's been difficult.
Yeah, and I've been able to connect with about 50% of my kids so far, and their major complaint is they just have nothing to do. They're scared to go outside, you know, and maybe technology's not as available, so they literally have nothing to do. Right. And I always suggest, like, read something, and they don't have books at home, and they just, like, don't know what to read. And so, I don't know, I have this idea where I'm allowed to go back into my classroom next week for a little bit. I might just get some books that I can, like, drop on kids' doorsteps or something. Because most of my kids will read, I think, in this time, just be out of boredom.
Yeah, it feels so frustrating to be in a situation where we have time to read, but there is a huge swath of kids who don't have the technology and internet access to be able to access what is available. And so the volume of kids' books that become e-books is already smaller proportionate to adult books. And then when you factor in access, it's a challenging situation.
Yeah, absolutely. I've got the kids that I've connected with are lucky to have internet, but I think the ones that I have not connected with yet don't have internet. And I know that there are a lot of free programs out there right now, but I worry that they'll get sucked into something that they can't easily get out of.
Yeah. Yeah, I have those questions about the free internet access. And if you don't have a computer, having the free internet access is also, you know, what are you going to do with it?
Right.
Margie, you and I think we both graduated from high school at the same time. And when I was, my mom was a library aide on my school's campus, and I went to a tiny school, so it was sixth grade through senior year of high school. And even within my time at between junior high and high school, her position was technically the same, but the library had, I think, very quietly become the media center, and it effectively ran the same way, but my mom's job was almost exclusively became teachers checking out TVs for their rooms and trying to, and like DVDs or whatever they needed. Thinking back to it, the perspective of that, I feel like it's been a really slow change that has been really hard to pinpoint and then therefore change at the right time. But do you have any memory of that really happening around you, even as you were going to school to be an educator? Like, what were they preparing you at all for, like, the evolution of this?
You know, I can't quite remember. All I can really remember is that we were encouraged to develop our own classroom library. Okay. So our professors must have been aware of this change. It was just kind of like the expectation, I think, of an English teacher is that you are going to have your own set of books.
Well, yeah, and a library to go to. But also, like,
right,
when you can, if you can think about the school you worked at before with a library and one now without, can you tell a difference in your students in terms of their interest in reading?
At my old school, I could kind of force them to be interested, if that makes sense.
Sure.
We would have, like, every Friday I would take them down and we would just, like, sit in there for 30 minutes and they'd have to read.
Sure.
And so a lot of them would end up checking a book out by the end of that 30 minutes. Now I just try to do like little book chats here and there in my classroom. And so I'll have like a handful of kids ask for books. And I like right before I saw a big uptick right before we went into quarantine of kids, I think recognizing that like, oh, I'm about to have a lot of free time. I should get a book. So I have like maybe I have 70 students. So maybe 10 of them regularly check something out.
Do you have support funding wise from your school or your PTO at all for classroom library building?
We just have a budget of about $150 a year for classroom supplies. So I can use that for books, or I can use it for other things.
When you say supplies, that also, I'm assuming, includes things like paper and pens and...
Yeah. Expo markers, that kind of thing. So yeah, it's not super cost effective. My district just adopted a new English curriculum, and through that adoption, the textbook company Pearson is giving each English teacher a classroom set of a novel. So that's kind of nice. So I got to pick one book that I'll have for next year. But again, it's hard with the English language learners because we had to pick a book that was on grade level from a specific list. So a book written at a 10th grade reading level is not necessarily the most appropriate for my kids.
Yeah, absolutely.
This is interesting because the other educator we talked to also sort of mentioned, we asked her about funds as well. And I guess, how much would you say, and you don't have to give a number, but just maybe like percentage wise, how much of your own money are you spending on your classroom library?
Oh gosh. I do not keep track of it at all. So I have no idea. It's probably way more than I think it is. I tend to buy books that I think my students will read, but like I'll read them first. And then I kind of twist it away as like, I'm buying this for myself and then I'm donating it to my classroom. I don't know.
You and I are friends, Margie. And I know that even you, maybe it was the beginning of this school year, you had said you took most of the books from your apartment and just put them in your classroom.
Yep. Yeah. So yeah, that happens a lot. So anytime people are getting rid of books, I just take them to my school.
So something that we do at the Blue Manatee Literacy Project is really focused on childhood literacy and making sure children who might not have the means to have books are able to get books, and that they are books that are appropriate and with characters that look and sound like them. A lot of the focus on that is like really young childhood literacy.
Yeah.
So I guess my question is, do you have any concerns or worries about your students, I guess, as they grow up and their interest in reading? Like, how much do you think it is impacting them now, or it will impact them later?
I think it's impacting them a lot now, and it's definitely going to have an impact on them later because, you know, studies have shown that the more you read, the better your vocabulary is and the better writer you are. And I think most of my kids could be much better readers and writers just with enough practice. And studies also show that an English language learner, it takes them like 7 years to truly be proficient in a second language. And they need to practice reading. Right. And that's probably going to be the easiest way for them to acquire new vocabulary. And especially in this time of like no access to books at all, their language is going to regress.
And you said you've been able to meet with like 50% of your students. I guess what kind of engagement are they showing you there in terms of their reading? I mean, and I'm asking because your job is, you're an English teacher specifically. So it's just really interesting to me that your school is set up to not really, this isn't like a dig or anything, but it's just that it's harder, I think, to support the English teachers at your school than I would imagine most of the other teachers.
Yeah. And I think just like, especially with the English language learners, it's such a quick growth that we're seeing, especially in Cincinnati, with immigrant families like coming here, that I think Cincinnati is just like trying to react, because they were kind of caught off guard by this influx. But with my students, virtually, I meet with them on like a video chat with Google Meet, and they're like working on their homework. The district gave them packets of work for each of their subjects, so I can help them with the English, and we talk about like the readings that they have to do and the vocabulary and some of like the language practice. But it's kind of hard from a video standpoint.
Right, that's something else too. Our the other educator, Joe, does she teach first grade?
Second grade. No, first grade.
First grade. Either first or second grade. And yeah. We had told her we were going to be talking to you, and that I was pretty sure your school didn't have a library. And she was saying like, I cannot imagine how difficult that is, because there's a big difference between me reading and showing a picture book to my kids virtually versus trying to connect with them, in especially at the high school age, with like novel form. Or now that you're saying, I didn't even think about the fact that you have a lot of English language students.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And even like the way high school English curriculum is set up now, we don't ever read like full novels as a class. I mean, I might assign a novel and say, hopefully you read this on your own time.
Yeah.
But the actual instruction part of me is we're doing like a lot of close read and analysis. So that requires that we take like a in-depth look at maybe 6 pages, like a chunk of the text at a time. And so we don't have the time to read, let's say, Beloved as a whole class together. But if we give them the novel at home, maybe they're reading it, maybe they're not.
Sure.
That's really interesting. And I'm marinating in something you said earlier about just being able to take the kids to the library and having the 30 minutes where that's the activity of browsing through the books. And I had not realized, it's not really a question, it's just more of a something we can discuss, but I hadn't really realized before this conversation that we've really taken away an opportunity to let kids just sit with books and browse and discover genres that are new or perhaps interesting to them. And we kind of live in this world where we're bombarded with information and everything all the time. And this quiet time to explore something that might be interesting to you, or a hobby or a recreation, and we've kind of taken away the opportunity for kids to discover that they might like reading, or that they might like reading specific kinds of books. And then you look ahead, I've forgotten the exact statistic that came out, something like only half of all adults will even read one book this year, or whatever that stat is.
Wow.
And I think, well, gosh, those are adults who had these opportunities. And when we look at this Corona thing is a great example of when you're trying to educate the public and get information out, and we're just kind of creating this situation where we have low interest and ability in reading, and we've taken away the opportunities. I don't know. There's no question in there. Well, I just don't know where to go with it.
And sorry, I want to add to that, that also I was thinking about that too, Jill, because it reminded me of when I grew up, and we did go to the library. It was built into our week. And I remember it being one of the first times growing up that I was making like a personal choice. And it was like, this didn't matter. You know, like I didn't have to ask somebody, like if a book looked good to me, then I got to pick it and it was mine. And I think a lot of that, I'm such a reader now because of the experiences I had as a kid and I mean, my mom was a big reader, but she also worked at the library. Like, I knew that it was a special thing because it was just ingrained in me in school and at home. But without that access, like, what kind of individual decisions are kids getting to make at a younger age, you know?
Mm. Yeah. And I think, like, in my own classroom, to your point, Jill, about just like having this time of boredom to explore, anytime I've had like unaccounted downtime in my classroom, kids have just like kind of merged onto our bookshelf. And so that's when they're just like, kind of like almost like an inquiry mindset of like, okay, what sparks my interest here? So I think that the more opportunities we give kids, even adults, just like time to explore and question, the more they're going to be interested in picking up a book and reading it.
Yeah, I was in preparation for recording this episode. I was just doing some research online, and there was a quote from a school administrator in the county, and they were building a new high school, and the school administrator said, well, we've decided that the new high school doesn't need a library because everything, you know, all the kids are one-to-one with devices and laptops, and we don't need books anymore, and all of the resources are available online. And I was just struck because there just seems to be a disconnect, because that's not what we're hearing from the teachers
and from professional medical professionals who are measuring the brain and are suggesting the complete opposite, that reading at a really young age instills success for children as they get older.
Mm-hmm. And I can't see from a school administrator or district's perspective that a library takes up space. And I think one of the biggest reasons my current school does not have a library is because of a space issue. We are totally over enrolled currently, and there is no space for an actual physical library because every inch of the school is used as a learning space.
That's an interesting point.
Yeah,
I hadn't considered that at all. That it is a really interesting perspective.
I'm also just now curious about, and I'm pretending I don't know you at all, Margie, but like, you're an English teacher, but you're also a committed reader and you love to read. I mean, mm-hmm. What was your experience growing up and what drew you to books in the first place?
What drew me to books in the first place? I think being one of six kids, you kind of get a little crazy with all the people running around you all the time. So books.
I have no idea what that's like.
I was about to say, Jill has four children at home, under the age of what, 11?
Yeah, our oldest kids are 11. I'm just sympathizing with you because especially during this time of shelter in place, there are six of us in this house 24 hours a day.
I can't imagine. Yeah, it's crazy. So I think I've like used reading as an escape and just like an oasis for myself. And I've always had a very active imagination. So that has kind of fueled my passion for reading. And it's just fun.
Yeah, it is fun. And I'm having read some of your writing, a lot of mm-hmm. what you write is also inspired by and based on other subjects as well. So it's an interesting, mm-hmm. like, I think there's this weird, not competition, but I think that every subject thinks it's the most important. But I think that one cannot live without the other. And that's certainly true for English. And I think the reality is that English is usually the one that gets the least amount of attention, I guess. But I mean, your writing has a lot of science in it, and mm-hmm. has a lot of math in it, but none of that would exist without any of you of your interest in English or reading.
Right. And I will say, like you said, that maybe like English doesn't get a lot of attention, but it does, and I just don't know if it's getting the right attention.
That's a good point.
Because like in the Ohio Department of Education, English and math are the like the pressure points of a school's success, because those are the tested subjects. And so they are getting a lot of support, but it's a lot, it's different support. So we're not focused on developing a kid's love of reading. We're focused on like teaching a specific skill to get them to be able to answer like questions correctly.
Test questions. Well, and that's interesting too, because
on a standardized test.
Jill, I wanted to ask you, I really remember just being asked, and maybe this is still happening, I don't have kids and I'm not a teacher, but a lot of my reading in school growing up was read this book, and then you met with the teacher, and then she asked you to tell you about it, and then if you liked it or not. Mm-hmm. And it felt like did this student understand it, and did they actually do the reading? But it was also just about having conversations around books and like what were they called, book reports. Doing book reports. Is that still like, Joe, are your children doing that sort of thing in school?
So here's what I see. As a person who has a wide spectrum of abilities in my family, I have a child who is a gifted reader, and I have a child who is on an IEP and has an identified learning challenge. I think time to be able to read for pleasure is afforded to kids with the highest skills mm-hmm. and abilities. Overall, what I see at the elementary level is that they are reading and they do have choice in text. I love that the Common Core standards have introduced really strongly reading of nonfiction. Our kids have read amazing books about animals and planets and science in a way that I don't think that I had an opportunity to growing up.
Yeah.
You kind of only read nonfiction to like research. And it has introduced reading nonfiction across the board. And so I love that aspect of it. But I also see our school does something called Grow Time, where after the kids have taken their initial fall assessments, there are identified areas of weakness. And so maybe kids aren't good at doing, you know, curriculum element 4.3, which is, I don't know, doing a plot summary or something. And so then they're what we would have thought of as maybe a reading group is focused on that skill and getting them up to where they are completing that skill. It's hard as a person on the outside to not feel like they're being coached to answer a question correctly. Mm-hmm. They do improve their overall skills. So I don't want this to become a thing about dunking on Common Core or dunking on teachers, because I think across the board, it has brought really great things to education that it does not give credit for. But it is very interesting. I would say my child with the highest ability is afforded the most opportunities to choose things that she wants to read and engage in activities. She's doing a whole project that was designed and executed just for her with books that she and her teacher have chosen together. My child on an IEP gets pre-printed sheets that work on specific letter combinations because you have to have that skill before you can move on to something else. But I definitely think it does have an impact.
Yeah, and it kind of made me think that I love teaching English and I love reading, but I love the way, to your point, Jill, that like Common Core has set up like English curriculum. So I love the fact that I can introduce a theme to my kids and we can read a variety of texts. We can read an excerpt from a novel, a short story, an article. We can listen to a podcast. We can watch a video. We can analyze a painting. And they all have to do with this one theme. And then kids can discuss the relationships and the different choices that different authors and artists are making to communicate those ideas. So, like, I want to keep that aspect.
Yes, I love that aspect.
Yep. But there almost needs to just be a separate time for kids to read or to give them time. And it might need to be outside of the English class.
Hmm. Yeah, I think that's almost because we have simultaneously made these curriculum changes, which I enjoy, but they have been accompanied by, it seems, a decrease in availability of library or just personal reading time. And they're almost two different things now, mm-hmm. but we've taken away access to one of them.
Something else that we talked about just was this really specific and shitty time we're in, and especially mm-hmm. for teachers and having to do all this virtual teaching. And Catherine, our other educator, was saying how it's been really hard, but it has also sort of cemented the fact that she really wants to be in this profession, in this career. And I was wondering, mm-hmm. although you mentioned you've only really been able to really connect with about 50% of your students, what has been a pro in the pro-con list of everything that's going on for you right now as an educator?
Yeah, I definitely want to keep teaching. it's really made me miss it. I think I can get bogged down with the stress of it, but gosh, I was not designed to be sitting down in front of a computer all day. I thrive on interacting with my students and asking them questions and letting them figure things out. So yeah, it's made me really miss it. But a pro would be just I really solidified different relationships with kids, and even kids that maybe I was kind of butting heads with over the course of the year have been really good, and it's been really sweet to see them.
Yeah.
I had said this to Catherine as well. I just really hope that in the future we look back at this time as a pivoting point in how we as a country and society talk about teachers and education and treat teachers. We have asked the impossible of teachers in this, and they have delivered.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Margie, thank you so much for sitting down and chatting with us today. I was just going to ask you, do you have any advice maybe for teachers who are finding this time particularly challenging or are struggling to connect with their students somehow?
I would say don't beat yourself up. I think it's really easy for me to look at, oh, I'm only getting 50% of my kids, but I'm getting 50% of my kids, and it's more than nothing. And just do the best we can. And I think just to be empathetic with our students, I think it's impossible for teachers to have the expectation that actual good work, perfect schoolwork is getting done.
Yeah.
I think all that we can focus on right now is just checking in with our kids, making sure that they're doing okay. And just being a space for them. I mean, my little virtual office hours each day have really been kids logging in, maybe asking me a couple of questions, but just sitting at their in front of their phone or their computer with my face on their screen, just doing their work. Mm-hmm. And so I think just being a presence for your kids is all that we can really focus on right now. It can be overwhelming to be oh my gosh, there's so much I have to do. And I'm definitely feeling that, but I'm reminding myself that we're going to be like this for a while. So I can pause and take a deep breath.
Yeah. One of my youngest daughter's morning meeting, they log on at 9:30 and do morning meeting. And today's morning meeting, her teacher was in their backyard and they watched her teacher's dog play fetch for a couple minutes. And it was, all the kids were smiling and it was just really nice to see everybody connecting, because I think they almost need that as much as they need curriculum and education.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, a sense of their any semblance of their former schedule.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you so much, Margie.
Thank you. This was fun.
Yeah.
It was a great opportunity. I have to say that even someone who is really connected to this issue, I felt like you brought so many points that I hadn't even considered. the impact on high school teachers, I think, is something that we don't necessarily automatically think of. And especially when you're serving ESL populations, that only exacerbates the situation.
All right. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
So that was really interesting.
Super interesting. And I want to hug Margie.
Me
I feel
too.
Like she has no support.
She is someone too who, like, I've known Margie for several years, and she's someone else who, like, lives and breathes her students. And So knowing how much work she's putting in also makes me want to give her a hug, and also like $1 million that I don't have.
Yes, I just want to like make it rain books in her school.
I mean, the budget that she has for her entire classroom, there's no way she's able to
Did she support. Say $150?
I think it was either $150 or $250. It was not much.
It was not much. And then she mentioned those Expo dry erase markers, which like those are in each of my kids' school supply lists every year. And I think like a 6-pack of those markers is like $17. Yeah. And you need like a million of them because they just like dry out and get used. And I was like, oh my God, Margie, I could spend $200 on Expo dry erase markers.
Right.
That's before she's bought any other supplies for her school.
Well, and it's an important point, because if we're talking about libraries, it's a distinct difference between Catherine's experience with a school that has a library and Margie's who doesn't, mm-hmm. who also worked at a school previously that did have a library. So she has the perspective. Margie has a perspective of, I know how it can work, and I know now what I'm having to do in place of a library. I mean, her students aren't being offered, I should say, she brought up a really good point about literal space and mm-hmm. how her school just doesn't have the space for one because they are over-enrolled. Yeah. And how do you serve as many students as you can and then not have the space for the things that you need?
Yeah, and I want to make sure that we're creating space in this conversation. Schools, we ask a lot of schools.
Oh my
gosh. We have the schools that we serve, especially at the Blue Manatee, they have health centers in them. They're organizing kids going to dental clinic. They're teaching entire families how to communicate in a second language. Oh. And they are wrapping their arms around kids. We're asking so much of them, and we're just not funding them appropriately.
Exactly. This conversation is for those schools, not against them in any way. I mean, it's
absolutely
like, this is not a dig towards her school at all. It's like, gosh, how can we help you? Because I know that you want this. Like,
yeah.
I really was interested in Margie's perspective, and she is such a reader, and I know that. And I wanted to know. I guess the part that really was surprising to me was the amount of English language students that she has. And mm-hmm. that is an added element to appropriate books for her students, because she has mm-hmm. to, you know, she has 10th grade level students, but that doesn't mean they're at 10th grade level reading necessarily. And if they don't have a library for that, that's putting a big strain on the teachers to make sure that the students have an interest in reading. And the appropriate books to read.
Yeah, one of the things when we start working with a new school or organization that delivers books for a literacy project through Blue Manity, I kind of just have this general demographic type survey that I ask them. I'm like, hey, how many students are you serving? What grade are they in? What is the ethnic makeup of the group of kids we're going to be serving in this project, and what is their current reading level? Because mm-hmm. grade level and reading level in so many of these conversations are not on par.
Yeah.
And so almost all of the books that we end up and in almost all of these programs that we end up serving, we're looking for a lot of those books that teachers and librarians call high-low books, where it's a high level of interest for an older child with a lower reading level. And it's a niche market within children's publishing, so that makes it hard. They're a lot of times done by small or specialty publishers. Sometimes they're done by education publishers. Just finding quality material is really challenging. It's not a big market. And because it's already a niche of a small market, the prices to deliver that stuff is just, it's just a lot.
Yeah. And it's also clutch. I mean, we have a lot of customers who come into the Literacy Project's retail space and are asking for, you know, my kid is such an advanced reader. I want to get them a book that is, you know, but we have to figure out really what they mean there, because it's, if we get them something that is too advanced, it's going to have the opposite effect and it's going to discourage them from reading because it's going to be too difficult. And that's fine.
Yeah.
Knowing that. So I totally hear what you're saying, because we deal with that every day in the store. And as a teacher, that would be really hard. How do I order or buy the books without really knowing yet what level my students are at? Because they're all, even any classroom has a range of reading levels.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. And then what further is exacerbated in some of these niche markets is that every challenging situation we have in general children's publishing, as far as diversity and own voices, all of those things are just exacerbated when you make the pool of resources even smaller.
Right.
I think, and so this is not an exact percentage because I'm going from memory, but I think it was something like, when you look at the books that were published in 2017, like for children, like 50% of them had white characters. And then from there, you go into like this huge percentage that have animals, and you get into like percentages in the tens and less when you start looking at some specific ethnic groups. And so when you talk about looking at a further niche, like a high-low book, and the entire publishing landscape only has, say, 3% of books that feature an Asian character, how many high-low books do you think you're going to get? I mean...
Right. That's a really good point.
Yeah, it just starts to get ridiculous.
Well, and in terms of general opportunity within just like having books within reach, we're in a situation right now. It's called the coronavirus.
I'm not familiar with it. What happens during just the coronavirus?
Like, yeah, it's this awful like pain in all of our sides that like won't go the fuck away. But we're trying really hard. We're all doing our part. Apparently, I hope so. But it's a really interesting time, especially to have talked to a first grade teacher and a high school age teacher, where they're being asked to do a lot of virtual teaching and virtual learning. And, you know, Catherine, who has younger students and a library in her school, her virtual teaching offers her the ability to read a book, show it to them, and they are engaging as close to exactly as they would in the classroom as possible.
Yeah.
Whereas Margie's situation is, she has older students who don't have access to a library at school, who don't necessarily have the means to get books. Right. I mean, well, they don't. I mean, everything's closed anyway, and don't have the internet access. And she said this, has only been able to engage with about 50% of her students. I think you said this in the conversation with Margie. I hope that we look back at this moment as a moment for change, because it is highlighting things that, like you said, you know a lot of these problems, but like the larger conversation maybe doesn't. And I think this is a great opportunity for us to recognize them.
Yeah, this aspect, here's what bothers me about this specific aspect of this topic.
Can't wait. Tell me.
I love it. Michael and I can see each other on FaceTime. And for a moment, his whole body froze in this super sassy pose that was like, I don't know. Anyway, here's what bothers me. This is where I get on my soapbox. I apologize in advance. Yeah. Okay, so we talk a lot about pre-literacy skills, and we have Success by Six and Every Child Ready to Read, and we have all these nationwide programs, and we have identified we have to get kids with the pre-literacy skills. We have to get them ready so that when they arrive at school, they are ready to learn how to read. Blue Manatee is a great example as a participant in that space. We know in Cincinnati that half the kids show up to the first day of school and they don't have the skills they need to be ready to learn to read. And that impacts their schooling the whole way. It's so hard to get caught up when you arrive at the beginning not ready.
Already behind.
But now we are welcoming them into these spaces where we know at least half of them don't have the skills that they need. And we've brought them into a building and taken away the support for their instructor and their access to materials. And we look so much, I think we kind of live in this world where we think everything's available online. And right. This is a perfect example of something that is so desperately needed by a huge percentage of children that is not available online to them in a way that they can access it. That's it. I'm fired up about this issue. I want more people to talk about it because it just, I feel like I so love reading and I want other people to love reading. But as a librarian, I just look at this situation and I think it doesn't make sense from so many angles. If you talk about people who just want to talk about school as a business and we got to talk about numbers, we have the numbers. We know that schools with libraries and with librarians outperform schools without them. When you talk to the teachers, they're saying these are resources that we don't have. And you talk to librarians and they're like, well, we have the knowledge and we don't have a way to share it with the people who need it. Right. And we don't have a way to deliver this resource to the people who need it. And it just seems like a problem that maybe we aren't I feel like it's one of those, like the train is coming and maybe we don't realize it's about to run us over because we're kind of caught up in the now of it. Right. But we are welcoming a generation of kids into schools and not giving them any literacy, any reading space within it.
Yeah. And it's, I love that we're having this conversation because I haven't reflected really much on how much the library system, my English teachers, having books like at my fingertips at school really impacted my love of reading. I mean, it's one of those things where I don't have kids and I'm not like in those conversations of what the schools are doing or what's happening in schools now. So I really do think I've accidentally been taking it for granted that the impact it had on me as an adult, because like you said, you love to read and you love books and I do too. And I think I speak for both of us when like that wasn't a lovely accident. It's because of the way that we were exposed to them and we're given the opportunity to fall in love with the books that we like and the people who are going to show them to us.
Yeah. And I think it's challenging because I look at my own experience as being a parent in a well-supported school district who our media specialist is amazing and does a really great job. And my kids do have an opportunity to check out books.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it just causes me a profound sadness that they're not experiencing quiet reading moments and sustained library time.
Yeah.
Because I just know that that's a loss.
Yeah.
And I think it's something that the people who are concerned don't know where to go with it. Because, I mean, I think we probably have what is close to a really high-functioning situation that's making me sad, not to mention what we heard from Margie.
Yeah.
And people acknowledge that schools are under so much stress and strain given their funding. And so you don't want to pile on and say you're doing a really bad job because it's both A, not true, right. and deeply unfair.
Yeah.
But it's like, so then where do you go with it? I mean, I just... Right. And that's the part where I don't know where we go with it.
Well, you know what? And I think that all unanswered questions start with challenging conversations. So I don't even know if we would necessarily know right now. And I think that's because of what you said, not enough people know about it. So not enough people are talking about it.
Yeah.
And I think that The most we can do is keep talking about it and support schools and students. And we're really lucky that we work for Blue Manatee Literacy Project, because our goal really is to put books into the hands of every child in the city, especially yeah. those who don't have, who aren't getting access to them. And if we can, if you and I and the Literacy Project can continue talking about it, and I think it's a really easy segue into talking about the library problem within the school system. So I'm really proud of what we do, and I'm really glad that we were able to talk to Catherine and Margie, because it does make me think, like, what does literally every single educator in the school system feel about this? Do we have time?
I'm excited to hear feedback. Me too. We've done a few of these episodes now, and it's great to hear back from people what they're thinking and conversations they're having with other people that this kind of was a starter for. And so I'm excited to see where things go. I hope that the conversation continues offline and that it continues to kind of bubble up in people's consciousness.
Yeah. So listen, this was so fun.
Yes.
I hope that Margie and Catherine feel heard. Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you have little ones out there who are kind of going through it right now and during the coronavirus quarantine without books available, like, contact us. We're the Blue Manatee Literacy Project, and we would love to hear from you and how we could offer some help.
Yep. Thank you for listening to Book It, a bi-weekly podcast. If you are interested in donating to the Blue Manatee Literacy Project, it is especially appreciated in our current situation. You can find us online for a direct donation or our online bookstore at bluemanatee.org. If you're in Cincinnati, when we reopen, come and see us. We are located at 3094 Madison Road in Oakley. This podcast is produced and edited by Jamie Ryan.